Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Dave Bazanko. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Tony talks to Charlie Holmes in Italy about the problems of dealing with rubbish, both there and in Bristol. He also talks to Greg Watkins from near Chepstow about the flooding in February. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have somebody you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
I'm Charlie Holmes. I've lived in Tuscany for a number of years, and I've been involved in environmental activities for about 25 years, so I've got to know the ropes, so to speak. And we got a local incinerator, which we've been fighting against for a long time, and so I've learned quite a bit about it.
So why are you fighting an incinerator? Because this is being pitched as actually quite a green solution. It's better than burying the waste.
Well, I don't agree with that at all, because if you bury the waste in its natural state, it's not going to do the environment much good, but it's not necessarily going to pollute the water table in such a way as if you reduce it to ashes, soluble ash, and then you bury it, then for sure it's going to pollute the water table. So, I don't agree with that argument at all, really. I would say you're planting a time bomb in the ground anyway when you plant waste, but when you plant it in the form of ash, it's worse, in my opinion.
So what's the crux of the problem of waste management?
Well, I think that the crux of the matter is that it's such a big problem that governments don't really have an answer to it. And it's a problem that goes on 24/7. I mean, you get on a train, this guy's going up and down with bags of rubbish. Anywhere you go, there's rubbish everywhere, and it's piling up every day. So it's a huge, big problem, which they have no real answer to. And so they'll take the easy way out. They're desperate. They take desperate measures. So incineration is a good way out of it. But what is the problem there is that they get into a conflict of interest, because they're supposed to be looking after the well-being of the citizens, but they also want to have incinerators on people's back doorsteps. And so you can see the reason why the government would facilitate the waste industry and the disposing of waste is the big problem. But what they actually do is they facilitate the business of disposing of waste, because the people who they get to dispose the waste want to make a profit, a big profit. And so they have to bend over backwards to keep these people happy. And that is where the big conflict of interest is, because they don't necessarily stick to the rules, because in the end, no one is really applying the rules anyway.
Here in Bristol, probably the most well-known problems we've had with waste is waste was being shipped out of the port, and then there were ships that nobody would actually accept, so it had to come back. So it seems as if people are very, very happy to export and do contracts to get rid of waste, but not necessarily to deal with it, because they see that as soon as the ship sails out of the port full of waste, that's the end of the problem.
Well, that is the idea, is that although now a lot of countries that they could dump stuff, like in Africa and places, they used to take stuff down there and dump it there and pay someone off and then go and dump all this stuff. Then the scandal comes out, they've got all this stuff there on the port somewhere that's all dripping into the sea. So I think now it's not so easy to take a ship and sail off somewhere and dump it, because these countries are more aware of what they're getting dumped on them.
Oh, well, there was a company called Sodexo here in Bristol that one of their ships actually just came back still full of waste, and then they had to unload it again a few years ago. But what are the principal myths then regarding incinerators? Have you got any examples of how they actually make things
worse?
Well,
we already did that one, really, haven't we? I mean, the fact that they're reducing it into ash makes it more poisonous or more easily to get into the environment.
So they're doing two things there, aren't they, really? I mean, if they're burning waste, you're going to end up with some of that waste going out as small particles into the atmosphere and the rest of it left as ash, as you described this ash.
Well, you've got bottom ash, the heavy ash, which they get from the bottom of the incinerator, and the fly ash that goes up to the top. Well, they're both considered to be dangerous waste. They change a lot of these classifications, but it's dangerous stuff. It's got all sorts of stuff in it, heavy metal and God knows what else. And that's the bottom ash, and that goes into the landfill. The top ash, I believe they put it into building material and they put it under roads. So when you're drilling a hole in your wall or something, you've got this breeze block or whatever the They put it in concrete, as they do iron filings from foundries. There's quite a lot of toxic stuff goes into cement and concrete and into building materials.
But this is so just they're not actually getting rid of the waste. They're just sort of losing it because, I mean, concrete is going to slowly erode over decades and maybe even hundreds of years. That waste is slowly going to be being released.
Yeah, well, that is basically it. But, I mean, there is no magical solution to it. I mean, even what they call this waste processing, all they do is get the paint and all the iron filings and stuff and the real toxic stuff, and they dilute it with, say, sawdust or other things which are not so toxic, and then degrade it as it gets diluted with other things. Then they take it off somewhere else and mix a bit of something else in with it. And in the end, in Italy, it ends up as organic compost, what it can do, because they just change the papers without actually doing anything to the material on the wagons. That's the one.
So, I mean, have you got actually any evidence of this sort of fraud?
Oh, yeah, there's been operations down here. There was one, because they make them quite, the cops do the investigations down here. One was called Cagliostro, because he was a famous alchemist guy. And what these guys were doing, basically, was driving the truck around the country. It goes into one place, they give him the dockets. He signs on something or other, then they give him another piece of paper saying that it's, you know, now the waste is in this condition, but without actually doing anything to it. So the cops called that Operation Cagliostro, and that's pretty much, I think I've got still records of that. Another one they called the Little Goldfish, because there were one of the roads was the gold. It was the golden fish. Anyway, they make all these little names up for these operations they do, which kind of relate to the crime. The only problem is in Italy is that environmental crime is basically like a parking ticket in the end, when they have a process where they kind of downgrade things and they make deal with the defense and the prosecution. And in the end, they say, well, OK, 20 grand fine, which to them is a parking ticket. I mean, they make millions.
It's almost like encouraging them to do it again with such a small fine. I mean, surely the fines should be in their millions or tens of millions at least.
No, they never find anybody that kind of money. I mean, they might find them a couple of hundred, but they probably spend more on the lawyers, on the legal fees, than they do on the fine. I mean, they got loads of lawyers on their cases. So, I mean, they'll go and have a long case, and in the end, they get their wrists slapped or something. They spend probably more on the lawyers than they actually get.
I mean, what you seem to be describing is a whole system of paperwork that goes along with the waste, different sorts of classifications of waste. And actually, this sounds to me as if the paperwork can just kind of get switched around. So you think you're dealing with some highly toxic waste. By the time you get to the end of the journey or at another point when it's passed on to somebody else, that waste is, you know, much cleaner than it actually really is. So is this largely a fraud by paperwork?
Yeah, and I mean, in the end, they get paid a lot of money to get rid of this stuff. So they got to kind of get shot of it.
But I mean, there must be a paper trail for that. So for example, if they're given a lorry with, I don't know, 20 tons of highly toxic waste, then surely they must have to come back and say, well, that toxic waste has gone here, and now we want our money for it, please.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how the paperwork on the money works, but I think they just paid contract. They get rid of it. I've got this waste. You come and pick it up. It's gone. You get paid. Because a lot of these wastes are liquid as well, and it can be like water, contaminated water from various plants. So what they do is they just leave the tap on the back of the truck open until all the stuff's run out on the road, basically. They do that, and there's all sorts of scams with it. They catch them now and again, sometimes doing it, but it's very rare. And as I say, environmental crime here is very, very, poorly. You don't get anything, basically. Parking ticket.
Okay, so, I mean, you know, what do you think of the way the law is operating? It doesn't sound like it's doing very well, because all this waste is being classified in certain ways. It sounds to me like there's a mass law-breaking going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know about England. I don't have any specific instances of England, but I've heard of it. I've read of things, people are doing things. But if you read the laws, and it's all very nicely laid out, and it's fine, and all the terminology is, it's all a bit mumbo-jumbo lawyer type speak, but you can understand what's going on, and it's all very well classified. The problem is that when you go onto the street where things are actually happening, and the actual physical, where the guys are going around with trucks, picking up stuff and taking it to wherever it's got to go, you find that things don't quite work the same, because if, for example, hospitals have different types of waste, so they should have a specialized unit going there and picking up the hospital waste, which includes infected materials and God knows what else. And it's also radioactive, because they use all the for the x-rays and all that. There's quite a lot of dodgy material in from hospital waste. Well, you would, if you go to the hospital, they say, yeah, okay, we've got this waste coming out of here, and we've got this waste. A bit like the bins, you see. You know, you've got the bin with all the different, where you put all your different things, and you lift off the top, and it's all just one bin. It sort of gets a bit like that, because they will send just one truck to pick up all that waste. So they bang in the hospital waste with the other waste. So it's mixed up.
So here in Avonmouth, there is actually a specialist in medical waste, clinical waste incinerator, which is separate to the others.
Yeah, well, that's where that waste should go there then. But if you check it out on the street, you find that quite a bit of that hospital waste will be... I mean, I tell you, one of the scams is they use all this very highfalutin technology. But then when you read the greenwash that the people put on, the local authorities, and they start talking in much more layman's type language. And like for Bristol, they talk about black bag waste. Well, I mean, so what is black bag waste? Waste in a black bag. But so if I've got like hospital waste and I stick it in a black bag and I load up a truck and then you get there and you say, what's that, mate? Black bag waste.
Well, I mean, black bag waste, surely they just mean ordinary household waste, don't they?
But that's what the idea is what they give you from this thing of saying black bag waste. But I mean, it's a very loose description, isn't it? I mean, it's waste in black bags. You're telling me it's from a house, you're telling me, but once it's on a truck and they're driving around with it and they go somewhere. If I fill up the black bags with toxic waste and slip them on this truck, which is quite easy to do, because I need to get rid of it. So I ask this guy, oh, look, can you take this away? Yeah, fine, boom. And so you've got toxic waste floating about in black bags. I mean, you don't have to be a magician to do that, do you?
Now, Charlie, earlier on today I put a call into Bristol Waste asking them to come on this programme. No reply. It's the same sort of thing you get from the mayor's office, I'm afraid. Just doesn't bother to even acknowledge that you've put in a request for them to comment. But they have a system now which used to be called the dump. You took stuff to the dump. Now they call it the reuse and recycling centre.
Yeah, well, that's just greenwashing, isn't it? They changed it, and all their trucks are all painted with flowers and little kiddies playing out in the street or something like that. And that's normal. The whole world has that. I mean, it's all the greenwash is the main part of their whole PR thing. Their whole persona is that. It's that they're doing a wonderful job. I mean, our incinerator down here, you believe them, it's like perfume with roses, and they're doing it, you know, they're putting things into the environment. They're helping the ecosystem, you know. They're like,
I mean, they do little projects at the local schools, don't they? We're planting flowers with the children, things like that.
Yeah, well, it's like they're like politicians holding babies, isn't it? I mean, the first thing they want is the baby in his arms, or she or he, whatever. They grab someone's kid and do a photo shoot or something. I mean, that's what they're on, basically.
But, I mean, people listening might think, well, you know, you're over-egging the pudding here. No one would be so cynical as to simply treat waste like it's just some kind of financial gravy train. But there is an article published by Reuters back in 2008 all about the whole situation in Italy. And it says, well, it's particularly looking at Naples, and that Reuters did a full investigation into the whole waste system in Naples, entitled Naples Garbage is Mafia Gold. A police officer wearing a riot helmet inspects garbage burning on a street in Naples. They say in the article, areas of the southern city, though, have ground to a halt because of piles of rotting rubbish, sometimes violent protests about what to do with it. And Italians are questioning whether organised crime is actually to blame for the emergency. The Camorra, the Naples equivalent of the Cosa Nostra Mafia of Sicily, have been turning filth into cash for decades in the city, says Michele Bonomo, president of the environmental campaign group Legambiente Campania. And it goes on, really, to describe the mafia being very much involved in the waste. Now, this is something which is not maybe happened so far. People are not aware of it happening in the UK, Charlie. Is there any truth to this accusation from Naples that Reuters have got about the mafia being involved in waste?
Yeah, it's common knowledge. They're involved in not only the Camorra, the old Cosa Nostra are more entrepreneurs now, but I mean, then being waste is legal, isn't it? I mean, so that, well, legal if you do it right, but they don't. We've got one down near us, which is onto that. They've been nicked a few times, but they carry on. Yeah, I mean, the mafia's got caves as well, so that's they control the mines of the marble, so they've also got places to stick it as well. they dump a lot of it in the caves of mines and all that. That's common knowledge, though. The other thing about that, though, that Napoli thing, was that during the real crisis, they shipped all the rubbish out to Germany, to Cologne, to the big buyer incinerator in Cologne. And they were burning it there for a while. I don't know how long that went on for, but they definitely were. They cleaned up Napoli for a while, burnt it in the buyer incinerator in Cologne.
I mean, if I could just quote the article a little bit more. Camorra gangs have also bought land at knockdown prices from intimidated small landowners and sold it at huge profit to companies involved in stocking bales of waste. This is just to store these bales of waste. The bales are destined to be burned in a giant incinerator, which is still being built. And I imagine, of course, that has been built rather like the one down the road from you in Tuscany, Charlie.
Well, here they call them termovalorizzatori, which is a word that doesn't mean anything in actual science or anything like that. A thermic valorizer or something like that, because they make a little bit of electricity out of it. And that's another one of their greenwash things, is that because they don't mention the gas they need to burn, but they do make a few megawatts of light. So, I mean, that's the whole thing. Is the thing is that they make it legal. This thing about facilitating the waste is that, I mean, you've got, what do you call them, sewers? Well, sewers have got the French government.
Okay, this is one of the two big incinerators down in Avonmouth.
Yeah, that's you've got them. Well, they're dealing with that, and they're running trains down from London. So they've created this big monster down there that they need, I don't know what it is, 250,000 tonnes a year, and they have to keep that thing going. I mean, if they say they're going to burn 250,000 tonnes a year, then they're going to burn that or more. And so they create a need, you know, they create a flow. They need that rubbish down there. So they get these trains running down to London. Well, the thing there is that if these local authorities in Bristol were actually on the case, they might go down there and inspect this incinerator and shut it down. Well, that would be like shooting themselves in the foot, because they've got to keep it going. And that's the whole conflict of interest. They can't monitor it, because if they do, and they do shut it down, then they're in the they got the railway line will be blocked up with trains coming down. The streets of Bristol are all, you know, you need the Camorra to come in and sort it out.
Can we just clarify this whole business of using gas? Because they're saying they're using it to generate power. Actually, if they're using gas, I mean, you can have a gas-fired power station anyway, which would generate power. So it doesn't sound to me as if these incinerators are quite all they're cracked up to be in terms of we're turning this annoying household rubbish, etc., into energy, because they're actually only able to incinerate it using natural gas, which is an energy source in itself and a fossil fuel, of course.
Yeah, they keep that pretty quiet about how much gas they use and what the gas bill they don't talk about. They talk about how much electricity they produce, but they need gas. They can also, it also depends on what they burn, because plastic burns pretty well. They don't need much. The problem is they haven't got any machines to sort out the organic waste from the plastic. So, and you get obviously black bag waste is everything.
But
so they
hang
need
on, I mean, plastic does burn well, but it burns with extreme toxicity. In fact, there are carcinogenic gases coming off of plastic as you try and burn it.
Yeah, they burn worse than plastic, though, for sure, because they actually burn toxic waste as well. So, I mean, you know, that's really toxic. Another thing what you want to ask them is, what do they do with the filters? How do they clean the filters? And the biggest question is, who controls the controllers? I mean, how do you know they are actually controlling that place?
So do you think there's any difference between the way that the Italians have been dealing with waste and here in the UK? Are we copying Italy, or what's the difference?
Well, the Italians are pretty badly organised on every front anyway. So, you know, things are, it's a bit slack, basically. So, yeah, but in actual fact, the problem is exactly the same. They got tons of waste. And they get help from the mafia, obviously, quite a bit of stuff that the mafia gets rid of in one way or another. Sink boats full of it, and they just make it disappear, and which is what the governments want anyway. In England, you got fly tipping and... but there'll be a few good loopholes for people, for sure.
And what about the company? I mean, I know you've had a look at the company. Bristol Waste itself is part of something called Bristol Holdings Limited, which is at arm's length from the city council. I think a main shareholder is actually personally the mayor himself, the way I understand it. But it not only does it control Bristol Waste, it also controls the ailing Bristol Energy, which has had £38 million of public money from Bristol City Council pumped into it so far, and none coming back and no prospect of any return from Bristol Energy. And the other aspect of Bristol Holdings Limited is the housing company, which is supposed to be building many, not affordable homes, but social housing it's supposed to be building in the city. So what do you make of this sort of arm's length business that's doing all these things? I mean, there is one major problem, and that is that they have all of the benefits of a public body in that it's publicly funded through council taxpayers' money, but you can't scrutinise it because it's a private business. So they seem to have managed to have all the advantages of both. And anyway, Bristol Energy particularly looks as if it's failing. We've also had a major scandal with Bristol Waste, where there's been drug dealing going on, or drug taking anyway, going on by Bristol Waste employees, and extreme physical assaults and bullying of a female member of staff, where the perpetrators simply haven't been disciplined by the managers of Bristol Waste.
Well, that's a situation that is the same here, basically. What you call it, PPP, public investment and private profit, and your incinerator down there in the on the coast, there is the same thing, PPP. So there's public money there, and then that's one of the things that helps the wheels of capitalism go. I mean, this sewers and all that, they're in there. And they don't pay tax, for sure, and there's a pot of public money, so that's normal. You're set up with these authorities, that's also pretty much normal. I mean, that's all pretty legal. They have a holding, and then they pump money into it, and yeah, I mean, it's kind of, what do you want to call it, a dodgy business, but there's nothing particularly illegal about it or anything.
Well, it's not illegal, but the thing is that you've got the kind of organisation that's set up as a for-profit business, but it doesn't have to make a profit. It's got guaranteed money coming in from the public purse, and yet it's not easy to scrutinise. In fact, it's very difficult. The other thing is, what about certain individuals seem to appear on quite a lot of these boards, not just here in Bristol, but in other parts of the country?
Well, yeah, well, they do, don't they? I mean, those people, they get big money, don't they? Those people who are directors of multinational companies, and that's how the market works. I mean, market is they get a lot of money. I think what you're saying about the workers is probably that, yeah, sure, the directors and all the top management get a lot of money, but the works are not treated too well at all. It's not a nice environment to work in. And also they're pushing for the profit. So they're progress chasing and making sure the people do as much as they can. I don't think they're probably very nice people to work
for. Well, I mean, what with your experience in Italy, what advice have you got for people in Bristol, particularly Avonmouth? Although, what advice have you got for those trying to fight such incinerators?
Well, I think you probably find that most people don't give a shit about it anyway. There'll be one or two activists, environmentalists, who are probably on the case. They probably know quite a bit about what's going on. The thing to look at is the source of the waste. And also, like I say, follow the trucks. Go and have a look on the street. Go to the local hospital and say, oh, where's the waste bins then? How does this work? And who's this guy coming in there with this truck? What's he taking away? What's going on? You know, just see how they actually operate. That's the way to do it. And there's quite a few other, you know, like things from chrome factories. I mean, the leather curing industry, we've got that here. There's quite a few toxic-y type industries, and also other sources of real toxic waste. And that's to see where's that going and what they're doing with it. And is that going in black bags and then just chucked in the incinerator? Because that's another thing, is what exactly are they burning in that incinerator? That's what you need to find out.
Well, you can't, because you can't get on site. You can't inspect it. Only the council can. Also, I suppose Bristol Waste don't get back to me if I try and contact them to give their side of this. But you seem to be saying that it's impossible to safely incinerate waste, but it isn't, surely.
Well, I think it is. I think you can't. If you're burning stuff, you're creating nanoparticles, which you can only create with ballistics and incineration. I think it's a pretty terrible thing. I told you about the ash. Obviously, if you can put stuff into a soluble, nice, fine ash, then you put it in a dump, then you're asking to pollute the water table.
Does it feature in the political debate locally in Tuscany or nationally?
When there's going to be an election, perhaps they might come up with it. If there's a strong enough feeling at the time, because it depends. I mean, the activists only have a certain amount of time. You can't be all time doing it. And every now and again, we give it a push. At the moment, there's a guy come on from Zero Waste, and they've got some good organisations. I mean, the idea of zero waste and 0 kilometres is very good. I mean, because we shouldn't produce any waste at all, and we shouldn't be moving stuff around all over the country like they do. I mean, all this what do they call it? Consolidation of logistics, isn't it? They call it in Germany now. They call it like that. But they take all the fruit up to Manchester. So if you grow strawberries in Devon, they take them all up to Manchester. And then if you're a supermarket in Devon, you buy the strawberries or you get them shipped from Manchester. So that's the sort of logistics. He's moving stuff around the country in trucks all the time. And they do that with waste as well.
So do you think that we should be just burying this waste? Is that what you think?
I don't think we should be producing it. That's what the problem is. We shouldn't be producing it. I mean, why do we have to wrap everything in plastic? I mean, I actually have my own composting system. I breed worms. And composting is very good for organic material. Obviously, I don't want to have anything to do with plastic. But the problem is they can't take it out of the plastic. Well, I take away the waste of a bar, a restaurant, every day. And I feed most of it to my chickens and my worms and stuff like that. And it comes in a big plastic sack. And I said to them, I said, look, can we do away with the plastic sack? I'll bring you a bin, like the old story pig bins, you know, at school and all that. And they said, no, the health and safety won't allow it. So, I mean, they're obliged. They have to put it in this huge, great plastic sack, which I get one of them every day. So I am actually, well, I don't produce it, and I'm actually recycling it, but I still have a big sack of plastic every day, a huge sack. And they mount up, you know. So the problem is the laws have made it so that all the food has to be wrapped in plastic. Well, when I was a kid, they used to wrap fish and chips in newspapers. And they had a bit of brown paper here. They wrapped everything in brown paper. Now brown paper's no good, or that kind of greaseproof paper. Now it has to be, by law, wrapped in plastic. So, I mean, how can you go anywhere when the laws state that everything has to be plastic, basically? And that's the problem. Well, when I was a kid, we used to go out and pick up the bottles that we'd find lying around, that they'd give you the money back on threepence or something like that. And then when you've got enough money, you go and buy yourself a bag of chips or something. And that's how we survived when I was a kid. Nowadays, nobody recycles anything. I mean, and it's the people are so now used to their lifestyle is that. Even my alternative friends, they create a huge pile of waste behind them, and they just take it and dump it in the unsorted rubbish. Once they've mixed it together, and I think that's they do this quite a lot because it's easier for them. Now they've got this system of incinerators, they just bung it all in a truck and burn it, where they should try and work out a way of collecting the organic waste without the plastic. But here, the people take that and they bung their organic waste in the bin, in a plastic bag. So obviously this is contaminated from the start. And you can't have a bin. You need a plastic bag. And so how are they going to separate that plastic bag from the organic waste, which is rotting away? It's pretty horrible.
Okay, Charlie, thanks very much for joining us.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Greg Lance Watkins, and I live near Chepstow, near the Severn Bridge. At the moment, the whole area is experiencing flooding. As you'll probably have noticed on the news, very acute flooding quite close to where we are. However, when I bought my house, I made damn sure that it wasn't going to flood, because I think you can safely assume, just looking back on history, that flooding occurs on a regular basis. If you look around where you live yourself, wherever it is in these United Kingdoms, you'll find that the great buildings like big parish churches, cathedrals and the like are all built on hills. They knew it flooded on a regular basis. It's only modern political thinking that hasn't twigged. There's nothing new about flooding.
Okay, well, we could talk about maybe climate change in a minute, but just tell us something a bit about your background, professional background.
Basically, I was fortunate enough to get something of an education. I went to school in Bristol, But much of my education was as a result of travel, having traveled extensively, literally around the world. I eventually, when I left school, joined the army, went to Sandhurst. But at the time, I decided that the army was not a career I wanted because we had made a decision not to go into Vietnam as a government. However, we had British troops in Vietnam wearing Australian uniforms, and I just felt this was thoroughly dishonest. Also, it was very likely that I could have found myself in Rhodesia, as it was, fighting expats on behalf of terrorists trained in Moscow. So I got out of the army.
Okay, so one of the people who's framed your ideas, I think it's fair to say, or at least shaped them to a certain extent, is the writer and journalist Christopher Story. He died, I'm not sure, was it in the noughties, but he's produced a tremendous amount of criticism of the financial system of the world and also particularly of the European Union. Now, I know you had quite a lot of conversations with Christopher while he was alive, and I wonder what you make of him, and did he come up, with you think, with anything purposeful, useful, original to help us understand how we got where we are today?
I think we can safely say that he knew what he was talking about on many issues. I think he tended to overcomplicate and overegg in many areas as well. And he did make the mistake of, in my opinion, rather too keen a devotion to conspiracy theories, because in my experience of life, a collection of particularly politicians and bankers would fall out with each other in their grab for power or grab for finance in such a manner that they'd never be able to organize a serious conspiracy that held water. Somebody would be stabbing somebody in the back within 10 minutes of it starting, and the whole thing would leak like a sieve. People who can't, to be put it bluntly, organize a tap in a brewery on a good day, what makes everybody think that they could organize seriously sophisticated scams?
Okay, because I mean, you had these, you know, long conversations with Christopher. Can you share with us some of his views?
He was very much into everything was driven by money, and he had a great understanding of money and how it moved and its manipulation. I think he had probably too much understanding at times, in that it meant that he couldn't necessarily see the wood from the trees. But I think fundamentally he was correct, and somebody has to be on that cutting edge when looking at complex areas of finance. Some indication of just how competent he was he was a private advisor to Margaret Thatcher for many years, explaining financial matters to her. And they all turned out to benefit the British people by her knowledge of it. It's how we have been able to rectify the problems that we've had in the modern era.
Well, I mean, Margaret Thatcher was a monetarist, and many people would say that during the 1980s she effectively asset stripped the nation.
Many people would need to actually look at the history, whereby most of the modern wealth within the nation was created by that monetarism. It's much harder to point out, and it's not actually necessary to crow about it if you've achieved what you set out to do. Much of the material was, much of the corporate material was put into private hands, because in public hands it was failing abysmally. Now, even if you take something as simplistic as the railways, in public hands it was a catastrophe right across the networks.
overpaying and costing a fortune, employing lots of people who were doing absolutely nothing except draw salaries, much the same as the steel companies before they became restructured under Margaret Thatcher. I would agree, however, that there are areas of the railways now that also have problems. But one problem of railways in general is you will never make a railway in Britain a success. It is just not possible. And the simple reason for that is the cost of running a railway is putting goods and people onto a railway and taking it off at the end of the journey. And if you're taking the journey from, Paris to Peking, you put it on once and you take it off once, and that is divided into the number of miles travelled between the two points. When you're doing it in Britain, well, fundamentally, you could spit across the United Kingdom in three goes. All the journeys are very short haul. Net result, it's incredibly expensive to run a railway. It will never pay.
Now, we're getting off the subject of climate change, but that's where we started. Let's go back there. What do you make of the people who are saying that the floods that you're experiencing in Chepstow are based on climate change or because of it?
No, it's an absolute nonsense. The biggest contributor to the flooding that's going on is we are draining all our fields, mechanically draining them, and refined drainage. We're using big industrial equipment to compact the soil as it goes up and down. We're only ploughing the top bit and disc-harrowing it for planting. We're not rotating our crops anything like as much as we have done in history. The water that falls at the top of the hill, whatever that hill might be, runs to the bottom of the hill within a day or so, and it's into the drainage ditches, and it's run into the rivers probably within 24 to 36 hours.
We're draining our farming land too quickly. Is that what you're saying?
That's a great part of it. And then great areas of our land we're covering in tarmac and concrete, or formalised gardens that are draining off onto tarmac and concrete, which means that none of this water is soaking in properly, because the land, when rain falls on it, should act as something of a sponge and absorb that rain into it trickling down into the ground.
Now, Greg,
you'll find in Britain, if you dig the top down 12 inches, the soil, or not at the moment, but many times of year, 12 inches under the surface is absolutely dust dry.
Okay, look, Greg, now if I was from Extinction Rebellion, which I'm not, but if I was, I would be pointing the finger at you and calling you a conspiracy theorist and saying you are a climate change denier.
I'm not a climate change denier. Nobody is more convinced of climate change than I am. It's been going on for 4.5 billion years on a very regular basis, cyclically. We've had periods of up to 10,000 years that we have more or less managed to prove when it has rained 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, everywhere on the planet. We've had other periods where it's been considerably drier. We've had ice ages, and where I'm sitting in Chepstow, in the last ice age, was 1 mile deep in ice. That's climate change. Mankind has had almost zero input to it. And I'm sorry, I am sick to death of these idiots in the Extinction Rebellion, because they haven't founded anything of what they're saying on fact. They come out with ludicrous comments, like 97% of scientists agree as a consensus that man is responsible for climate change. Well, firstly, it's a lie. Secondly, nobody has ever said that. It was published by Obama, completely out of context, and it has been talked up ever since. And of the thousands of scientists, they they only interviewed the ones who produced papers that were written to point out man had a responsibility for the climate.
So how do you put down the idea that there is an island in the Pacific which is slowly the water level is rising and it's sinking below the surface? How do you put down the fact that we see so much less in the south of England anyway and in the lower ground across England and Wales that so much less snow than we did even just 20, 30 years ago?
20, 30 years? Oh, a moment. A moment in time. That's quite ridiculous to think in those terms. We used to have lots of snow in the 1960s. We had a period of snow. We had a period of very warm weather after that. We've had a 0.8 degree rise in temperature in the last 150 years. I agree with you, that is climate change. We've had, but it is a minuscule climate change. The glaciers in Greenland at the moment are growing at quite a prodigious rate. The brand new icebreaker that Norway has commissioned, the Prince Haakon, had to turn back because it ran into ice that was too thick for it to break in areas that they didn't think had ice.
Okay, so if you're painting a picture here of a kind of hysteria, if that is true, what's driving it?
What's driving it? Look out over any area of Britain at the moment and you will see a wind turbine, no doubt. It doesn't produce electricity efficiently. It is obscenely environmentally damaging. It cannot be recycled. It's built onto hundreds of tons of concrete block full of steel rebar that has to be manufactured. It has a life expectancy of 12 to 20 years. If it has maximum output for 20 years, it will not compensate for the CO2 that is used to manufacture the concrete block at the bottom.
Now, hang on. I mean, this is a marvellous technology, many people say. You're sounding like a bit of a Luddite.
Indeed, I am. I'm definitely a Luddite. But don't forget, scientists for many, many years were convinced that everything in the heavens revolved around Earth. And they used to lock people up or put them on fires for telling the truth. Then another bunch of scientists came along and they said the Earth was flat. And they fought that tooth and nail. And the next bunch of scientists comes along and they're telling us that there's no such thing as plate tectonics. And it was only, 50, 70 years ago that plate tectonics were proven beyond a shadow of doubt. And then we have scientists, all of my youth, who were saying that we would be in an ice age by the millennium. That didn't happen either. And then we had doctors and medical scientists for many years telling everybody they had absolutely nothing to worry about from smoking. Perhaps we're all Luddites when we actually know what we're talking about on the subject.
A lot of people do believe in climate change, though. Do you think there's a certain amount of groupthink here, and if so, why?
Of course a lot of people do. A vast amount of money has been poured into propaganda, and we're being led by a 16 and 17-year-old now, with serious mental health issues, whose family industry has been climate change ever since her great-great-great-grandfather was awarded a Nobel Prize, bearing in mind he was on the committee of the Nobel Prize. He was awarded a Nobel Prize for inventing the term global warming, and at the time he defined exactly how much CO2 had to be released into the atmosphere to create a degree of temperature rise at a time when it was impossible to read how much CO2 was in the atmosphere.
Now, you're painting a picture of a kind of climate change movement which is funded rather than some sort of naturally evolving thing. This brings
funded?
Us back.
Yes, it is.
Well,
yesterday.
This brings us back to Christopher Story and Follow the Money and his philosophy. What did he say was the centre of the spider's web of the money system?
Basically, it was a collection of people who were consorting together to profiteer in their own ends. I never managed to get to the bottom of exactly who and where they were, because most of what he was explaining sounded far more like blatant highway robbery rather than anything tremendously sophisticated.
There is definitely
fascinating. If you can plow through them, they are incredibly hard work, even if you have some understanding of finance.
I mean, one of the things in finance is fairly well known is this whole thing of insider dealing. So if the banks or whoever is about to finance something, they will tell a few people who may then invest in it and find that their investments grow. So if you're friendly with certain people at the top of high finance, you can make a lot of money just by knowing them.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, it's professional gambling in pinstripe suits using other people's money, isn't it?
Also, you're in Chepstow there. Are you enjoying the being able to use the Severn Bridge to go back and forth for free now?
Yes, I have very little use for it myself, but I think it's much more sensible being free because the cost of administering it was basically unfair and unreasonable. It threw a huge amount of very damaging traffic off of the motorways and onto side roads to avoid the fees, and it became worse and worse in those terms. I live on the A48, and they've been tarmacking that on such a regular basis to cope with the wear and tear. Yes, it's much better now that we not only have a toll-free bridge, but it also has an alternative. So we've got two bridges for the price of none.
Now, the Welsh government were lobbying for a long time to have those tolls dropped. Does that mean the end now to attempts to devolve from Britain, the Welsh government and the Welsh people?
I think the Welsh government to call it the Welsh government is farcical anyway. In the last 20 years, which is the period for which it's existed, I have been challenging them on a regular basis because I was a founder member of the No to Devolution campaign, just as I was campaigning against membership of the European Union or anything similar at the beginning of the 60s. Because I think this concept of endless tampering with what works to try and give different people an opportunity to rip off the system to their advantage is a nonsense. The Welsh, in 20 years, their regional assembly is nothing more than a superannuated council with a collection of politicians who really are utterly incompetent at almost everything they touch, who have taken over what was the Welsh office, which was run by one minister of state and a staff of about 10. Now we have 60 assembly members with a staff of 5,000, and they have achieved considerably less on a per diem or annual basis in those last 20 years. In fact, I have challenged them to give an example of a single solitary achievement of which they can be proud that has served the majority of the people of Wales and Wales itself. And they fail, fail, and fail. Their educational standards have dropped like a brick. PISA results, which are the international method of measuring education, shows them falling down through the tables to the lower levels. The NHS in Wales is in dire trouble, and it's in such dire trouble that certain hospitals over the border in England won't even accept patients from Wales because Wales so frequently defaults on the bill.
Well, look, I hate to be so cynical, Greg, but many would say, well, the central government have simply not been funding Wales and they've cut from many places around the country, their funding to local authorities, including here in Bristol, dramatically, that's really because the Welsh people, generally speaking, don't vote Conservative. So why should we fund their local government, as they see it, or regional government?
Well, if that's the case, they're failing abysmally at cutting the costs of Wales when you think they've made good the $14 billion shortfall on the Welsh budget, and every single person in Wales per capita spend is higher funded, or should I say supplemented, across the border from the rest of the United Kingdom. The cost per person in Wales is higher than anywhere in the rest of the United Kingdom. And just as Scotland is funded, so also is Wales, but to an even greater extent per capita.
So do you think there are going to be continuing calls for devolution from Cardiff?
I think there is quite clearly a greater and greater call for abolishing the Assembly. We're now looking at somewhere in the region of 24% of the electorate in Wales would appear to have an interest in, if not abolishing, at least curbing the powers of the Assembly, because the Assembly has never had a realistic mandate to exist. It had a tiny turnout for its original devolution vote. It's never got anywhere near as high since in other votes, and it only passed by rigging figures and fiddling them, and it was 0.03% in the final figure they managed to fiddle into existence in favour of devolution. It's a busted flush. It's just that nobody's actually got the inertia to stop it.
Interesting.
Because the people with the hands on the power are not the people of Wales or the region. Wales is just non-viable. What is its export? What does it manufacture? How is it going to pay its bills? And at the end of the day, nobody seems able to answer that question.
Well, what a rather bit of a cliffhanger you've left us on there. But anyway, Greg Lance Watkins, could you just give us an idea of where people can find you online or anywhere else and follow some of your work?
I have a website, if you're happy for me to advertise that to people. It's infowebsite, all one word, .uk. And you'll find there's about 40 different major topic brackets on that website, and they are incredibly eclectic. There is something for everybody on there, and you can also track me down from there easily, so that you can pick up on my Twitter feed, or if you wish to get into conversation about any of those issues, I am readily available. So that's infowebsite.uk.
Greg Lance,
and I look forward to hearing from you.
Greg Lance Watkins, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Charlie Holmes and Greg Watkins, and to Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. You can phone them on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of other opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. I'm Dave Bazanko, wishing you a very good week. Till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. And a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.